I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We continue meeting some of the local journalists in town that are noted for their award-winning work, as I'm joined now by Travis Lupik. Georgia Strait staff writer has won many awards for his reporting, including a Jack Webster Award and a Canadian Association of Journalism Award. I follow Travis's work, and his reporting on the drug crisis in Vancouver is top-notch and insightful. I'll ask him about that which he reports about in and around Vancouver's downtown east side. We're hearing all the time the numbers of deaths due to the opioid crisis, and Mr. Lupik does more than just report statistics. I'll get him to tell us about his beat, the stories that interest him, and how he confronts the work he does, especially since it can almost always affect one mentally and physically, being at the front line of an emergency. Perhaps we'll get into the solutions, political and otherwise. There'll be a new government in Victoria shortly and a by-election for Vancouver City Council soon. So what will that yield? Travis works for the Georgia Strait, which celebrated its 50th anniversary this past spring. We'll reflect on where he works and how he views its place in the media in this town. Visit tlupik.com for more. The Twitter handle is at tlupik. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Travis Lupik. Mr. Lupik, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it. So for people looking in and wondering what's happening in Vancouver, it has been a crisis for a long time, and it's still very much a crisis today, isn't it?
Very much it's a crisis today. If I have to pick a date for when our drug overdose problem began to reach epidemic levels, and that is what we're calling it today, an emergency, a crisis, an epidemic, that was probably around 2012, 2013. By then, the numbers, the number of annual deaths in the province had almost doubled the numbers and the averages that we saw 5 years earlier. So we're a few years into it now. The scary part is we were reporting on it as an emergency, as a crisis, as an epidemic about 2 years ago. Those were the words that we were using, really strong, shocking language. And the number of deaths that we were seeing 2 years ago don't even compare to what we're seeing today now. Like, they've doubled again since we began calling this a crisis.
What accounts for the fact that there are so many deaths? Is it the kind of drugs that people are ingesting, or is it a criminal element? Are they getting, say more ubiquitous in this town?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, but I'll use the phrase perfect storm. Beginning about 10, 15 years ago, doctors began to prescribe opiate medications for pain much more than they used to. This was largely in response to marketing by pharmaceutical firms that said that these new magical opiate pills, Oxycontin, were not as addictive as previous pain medications.
So like Vicodin and these things that you would get after surgery.
Now it turned out they were absolutely addictive. We're seeing more and more evidence that the drug companies actually knew this, but doctors were told that they were not addictive, which was like the holy grail of medicine, a pain medication that's not addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And so especially in America, but also especially in Canada, compared to the rest of the world, North America really started pumping out these opioid pain medications. Then about 10 years ago, 5 to 10 years ago, we started to figure out that's a bad idea, and doctors began scaling back their prescription practices. A good idea, but the unintended consequence was so many thousands of people who had become addicted to these prescription pills then had to find a new source, and that became street heroin, illicit heroin. At the same time that all that was going on, drug cartels, mostly in the United States but also in Canada, were expanding into new markets. They weren't just dealing in Miami and New York anymore. They were dealing in rural Ohio and North Carolina and Kentucky.
That's why you hear pillbilly heroin and things like that, yeah.
The organized crime moved into areas where it had never operated before. So you had all these people coming off of prescription pills looking for something else, and drug cartels saying, here's something else, in areas where they never had before. And then fentanyl arrives. So you have a prescription pill epidemic, and then heroin arriving in new markets, and then fentanyl arriving in North America, which is way more potent, more dangerous than heroin. So it's these three things going on that have coalesced into a really, really scary situation.
Now, is fentanyl, can that be found in anything? Because, I mean, that's a thing that we hear in the media, that when they give us warnings about the danger and not to use alone and things like that, that it can be found in everything. So even like pot, say.
It can be found. I mean, theoretically, it can be found in anything. But I'm very careful not to overstate it, because then I think, you know, if you cry wolf, then people won't pay attention to what you say. In British Columbia, we've never seen fentanyl confirmed in pot. Mm. There were initial reports about that a couple of years ago, but they were pulled back. You're finding it in heroin for sure. I don't even know if there's actually any heroin left in BC. You're for sure finding it in more cocaine, which is scary because then you're introducing it to users who are not used to dealing with opiates as opposed to heroin users who are, so it's even more dangerous. There's reports that you're finding it in other things like crystal meth and ecstasy, but those are numbers are very low and largely anecdotal. It is still the hard drugs that are of the biggest concern.
This may sound like a silly question, but I know nothing about drugs and never have used them other than, say, Advil or aspirin. But say the recreational cocaine user that used cocaine 10 years ago, and you know what sort of person I'm talking about, you know, the businessman or whatever,
yeah, the
right?
The lawyer, the accountant.
Yeah, sure. The cocaine that they're getting now, as opposed to, say, 10 years ago, if it had fentanyl in it, is it more addictive than, say, previous was? I mean, I understand that all drugs can be addictive, right?
Yeah. I mean, it would be, but it's a different kind of addiction. And because they're ingesting it through their nose, it wouldn't be quite as quickly as addictive as if they were injecting it. So there is that risk, but the greater risk of fentanyl contaminating the cocaine supply is you're putting it into a body that is not has not built a tolerance for opiates, so they're going to be at an even higher risk of an immediate overdose.
Well, when we talk about the how we talk about the drug crisis, what role does the media have to play? And when you think of your own work and the work of your colleagues in this town, do you think a lot of the media in this city get it?
I do. I think Vancouver's media has done a pretty exceptional job covering the drug overdose crisis and fentanyl. I always joke that 90% of my job is just that of an educator. We really just are teachers. And I think the Vancouver media, at least, the BC media, has done a pretty good job educating the public about fentanyl. They haven't been over-alarmist. It is a scary situation, and I think that they've got that across in a proportional manner. I think that they have done a good job looking at solutions to, and even solutions that in other jurisdictions would be considered pretty radical.
And do you think that's had an effect on where the public is and there's, say, attitudes towards, say, the legalization of drugs, which a lot of people think is the solution here?
I think it is. I think it has had that impact. You know, in Vancouver, we have a prescription heroin program where actual taxpayer dollars are paying for people to be administered injection heroin. In many other jurisdictions, in many other cities, there would likely have been a public outcry about that. But because it's been covered by the media here in a way that's actually quite thoughtful and nuanced, I think that most people living in this city get it. Or at least if they don't get it, they at least hear the experts saying, this isn't as bad as an idea as it sounds. There's actually benefits here. And so you are seeing Vancouver debate potential solutions much more openly, more in a more educated manner than you see in a lot of other cities.
But you also see this happened, I can't even remember when this was, but it was in the last 6 months or so, when city council wanted to impose a tax on property owners to help deal with the crisis. So sort of the ignorance that came out that why should my tax dollars be paying for this? And so there's that great thing to overcome, isn't it? The attitudes of people. And I don't know, do you think they're ignorant to understanding addiction?
Yeah, I actually filed a couple of freedom information requests with the city of Vancouver so that I could read all the public feedback that came back on that issue. The issue was I think it's a 1.5% increase to property taxes.
So these are people emailed City Hall and
yeah.
things like that?
Or yeah. You call 311 and you say, this is feedback on the on the property tax increase.
Sure.
You're right. Most people were not happy about having to pay a little bit more each year for the value of their home, for treatment options, for that sort of thing, for drug users. But what I saw in those emails is it kind of got wrapped up in a few different issues. Property taxes had been soaring for a few years.
Yeah.
So people were already feeling a little bit bitter over that. And then, and this was a modest tax increase. I think if you owned a two-bedroom home, it only came out to between $100 and $160 extra dollars a year. It might have been even been as low as $80 extra dollars a year. But people didn't like their property taxes going up even more after they already had. It attracted some emotions from the real estate debate in Vancouver and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. I think that the city made a poor choice in choosing to tie real estate to the drug issue. I think if they had approached or looked for that sort of tax in another way, I mean, the response wouldn't have been as angry as it was.
Taxing plastic bags or pop or something like that?
I think it would have been much easier for people to swallow. I think that the tax for treatment options for drug users sort of got wrapped up in the real estate issue that way.
I'm going to divert just a sec because this brings up another thing that I'm interested in. This current government, I would think that this has made them unpopular if they weren't unpopular already. We have a by-election coming up. What do you think are the issues, I mean, that we'll be talking about as we talk to these candidates that are running for this one seat on city council? I mean, the drug crisis will be first and foremost, won't it?
I don't think it will.
Really?
In my mind, it should be.
Yeah.
Vancouver has lost so many citizens to this crisis. But the real estate issue has just dominating everything and is dominating so much political discourse and so many political debates right now that I think that you're not going to see talk about the drug crisis the amount of talk about the drug crisis that it deserves. 967 deaths last year, and yet in the provincial election last May, I didn't see overdose deaths emerge as even maybe one of the top five issues. During the final leadership debate, which I think went on for around 90 minutes,
mm-hmm.
I counted the drug overdose crisis getting less than 60 seconds of attention. I think it was 70 or 80 seconds in a 90-minute debate after 967 people died last year. I think you're probably going to see that again in the civic election. It's not getting the attention it deserves.
We're seeing a new government come in the next week or so in Victoria. One assumes that the provincial government's response then will be different than the current provincial government's response. Are you hopeful on that score?
I'm hopeful. About the new NDP government, I'm in a wait-and-see pattern. Something that's really concerning about the government's response to the overdose crisis is that the Liberals' response was actually pretty good. They've actually done a pretty good job on this file, and yet we're still seeing deaths skyrocket out of control. Where the old Liberal government definitely deserves criticism is on the treatment front. They really did an excellent job on harm reduction, but on the treatment front they could have done more. But overall, I think that their response was actually pretty well done. But the problem is just so massive that the deaths still went up.
So is the status quo then tenable under this new government?
I can't say that the status quo is tenable with the deaths where they are.
Yeah.
So I am hoping that they will come in with some new ideas at least.
But from their platform, I mean, did Horgan and his crowd say anything different? They obviously said something a little bit more than Clark and her platform, right?
They did say more in their the NDPs and the Greens both included more in their platforms on the fentanyl crisis than the Liberal government did. The big promise from both of them on this front was a new Ministry of Mental Health and Addiction, actually breaking that out of the Ministry of Health.
Mm-hmm.
There's pros and cons to that, though. If you give addiction its own ministry, it's obviously going to receive more attention. But you risk siloing it and breaking it apart from the larger healthcare system and potentially creating more trouble than it's worth. There's a lot of potential pitfalls and a lot of potential unintended consequences with that plan.
Yeah, I think that's the problem that citizens in this town don't understand when they're ignorant or say dismissive or complacent about the drug crisis, is that it affects everything, and so if just because it's a mental health issue or an addiction issue doesn't mean that it's not an overall health issue.
Yeah. And there are some really big issues behind the issue of drug overdose deaths. You know, behind drug overdose deaths is the issue of addiction, and behind the issue of addiction are the much larger issues of where we're at as a society and why there's so much anxiety around young people today, and cities having grown so fast and people feeling dislocated from where they grow up and that sort of thing, that this gets to become a pretty tough problem when you take a step back and try to actually address its roots.
Now, is the law enforcement part of this and sort of getting the bad guys who are selling the drugs? I mean, are we past that point now?
Law enforcement is not as big a piece of this as some people might think.
Like, I mean, we hear the thing of like, cracking down on all these drug pushers and drug dealers. I mean, if we did do that, would it help the overall picture, say?
I don't think it would help.
Really?
I think that we've been fighting the war on drugs and arresting people and throwing dealers in jail for 40 years, and I've never heard anybody say, well, this might be the last time we ever do cocaine.
Yeah.
It hasn't slowed in any way the production and distribution of drugs in 40 or 50 years. And we're starting to see more and more people in government recognize that. The Vancouver Police Department is really not that involved in the fentanyl crisis. They do not respond to overdoses. When you call 911 for an overdose, the VPD doesn't show up. That call goes to ambulance and fire, and the VPD don't even send anybody, which is a great thing, actually. It means people who have somebody experiencing an overdose will be more likely to call 911. But the VPD is also not doing as many street-level busts as it used to. They're not bothering to arrest the dealer on the corner. Because they've actually recognized the dealer on the corner is low enough that he's probably just an addict themselves, that somebody's going to replace him literally 5 minutes after the police take him off the street, and that he'll be out within a couple days of jail anyways. At the higher level of law enforcement, you know, where you're busting producers and that sort of thing, the problem with fentanyl is that most of this is coming from outside of Canada still.
When we see that on TV, the packages from China and
In the United States, a lot of fentanyl is coming from Mexico, but in Western Canada, it's my understanding most of our fentanyl is coming from China. There have been a couple of big busts, but fentanyl is really tough to tackle with law enforcement. It's such a potent drug that it can be shipped in incredibly tiny amounts that just sail through borders without any trouble. I think that you could throw dollars at this problem through law enforcement endlessly, and you would not even slow fentanyl production and importation to Canada. It's just a really tricky problem.
Back to the by-election here in Vancouver, I find this very interesting that we're all thinking about this one seat when during regular elections or the general election, there are 10 that we think about, but people don't vote that way, I guess, at an at-large system. There's no chance that Vision's going to retain that seat, is it? Are they?
No, I think there is.
Really?
I think that people...
And we're talking, by the way, on a Thursday morning when there's only been really one candidate who's announced, right?
We don't actually know how this election's going to play yet. It's still pretty early. I know people are really unhappy with Vision, especially on the housing issue, but also on the drug issue. But there's a lot of things that receive less attention that I think people are pretty happy with Vision for. You know, it's a green city. If you own a home, you're doing pretty well. Bike lanes attract a lot of negative feedback, but a lot of people use them and like them too. And this, you know, this mayor's as an individual, I think, is still quite popular. I think it's going to be a close election, actually.
Yeah, and if by-elections, we look at the pattern of by-elections, I mean, the turnout will probably be very low.
Yeah.
And so the people that generally vote are sort of supporters of one party or another. And
so what party has the sort of ground infrastructure to get people out and voting? And that's often the party in power.
Yeah. So Judy Graves is the one name we're hearing a lot about. And she's announced Thursday morning that she's going to seek the seat for one city, Vancouver. Are there any other names that you're hearing that are considering this seriously?
Not yet. I think that I keep hearing Patty Baucus, formerly of the Vancouver School Board. I keep hearing her name tossed out. Not from her, though.
Yeah.
She hasn't said whether or not she's going to run. If she does, I think that she would be a very popular candidate.
And she would run with Vision.
Yeah.
Are you hearing as well that there'll be the school board, that they'll be replacing that on the ballot, say?
I haven't heard that yet.
Yeah, but that's generally what people are thinking, aren't they? That we'll be voting for one city councillor and then, I can't remember how many school board trustees there are, 9 or something like that?
I can't remember either. Yeah. But, I mean, it would make a lot of sense, but I just haven't heard that yet.
Yeah. I'd like to touch on real estate just a sec, because, I mean, that, as you said, it's something that a lot of people are talking about. A lot of your colleagues in the media are also talking about it a lot. And do you think that that's accurate as to where the public is?
Yeah, I think it's the hottest issue in our city right now, which is unusual for an issue that we've been talking about every day.
For a long time.
For a few years now. Yeah. Issues usually burn out. People just get a little bit tired. They start clicking less, and the newspapers sort of move on a little bit. In 2014, all we reported on was marijuana, and then people just sort of moved on. But with real estate, it's kept right at the top of, you know, newspapers' most popular boxes on their websites.
At your paper, is that the case?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's still the real hot issue. And I think it's going to continue to be as long as there's so many people who grew up here who can't afford to stay here. It's a really emotional issue for people. I don't think that's being appreciated in the debate, is just how emotional it is. When you're talking about people who can buy homes and who can't, you're striking at people's identity. I grew up in this town, so I deserve to be able to buy a home here. There's a sense of entitlement, and I'm not necessarily using the word in a negative with a negative connotation. So I think that's one reason that the real estate debate continues to attract so much attention, because we're really talking about how people see themselves and how they view their futures.
But there hasn't really been a change in sort of what's happening, is there? I mean, no. We're hearing people moving away. There's an empty homes tax now here in Vancouver. But it's generally been the same thing, hasn't it? I mean, the policies are provincially, municipally, are still the same.
Yeah, well, we've seen a couple of big measures. The big two are the empty homes tax, which you just mentioned, and then the foreign buyers tax for people who are purchasing homes from outside the country.
Yeah.
But the market's had time to react to those measures, and it hasn't actually really done much.
The price of a house is still relatively the same, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
The crash that I didn't think it was going to happen, but the crash that some people thought might happen after that sort of government intervention occurs hasn't happened. So what's next? Well, prices are probably going to continue to go up, and people are going to continue to be unhappy about that.
Journalists are not really good people to ask about the future. I mean, you're not clairvoyant, but I mean, when you think about it, do you have a sense of what will happen?
I've gradually come to take a very high-level, wide view on the Vancouver real estate issue. I no longer view it as a Vancouver issue. I think we're likely in the middle of a process of urbanization across North America. You know, where people lived in cities, and then cities got so big that, and I'm talking about 1800s now,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, not everybody could live downtown, so they started to branch out into the suburbs to get away from these really dirty urban cores. That was a very fashionable thing to do for many decades. And so, you know, you saw the expansion of suburbs across North America. And now you're seeing that flipped a little bit, where more and more residential units are being built in downtown cores, where people continue to leave rural communities for cities. And perhaps most important, where for the first time in human history, really, one city's urbanization is actually a global phenomenon, where capital is invested from all over the world. And all of these things are not just happening in Vancouver. We're not special in any way like that. Vancouver's real estate market has gone crazy, but many other cities have as well. If you think an apartment in Vancouver is expensive, try looking for one in Manhattan. The prices are double what they are. I have friends in Manhattan who pay $5,000 for 400 square feet.
Rent a month?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's obviously affected the downtown east side. And I guess gentrification is another thing that neighborhood is in the midst of.
Yeah. The downtown east side is
Chinatown
geographically,
as well. Yeah.
And Chinatown, yeah, and Gastown, yeah. It's in a very interesting position geographically, because it's on the eastern side of the downtown core, and on the northern side, the western side, and the southern side of the downtown core, you have water. And so there's sort of, I imagine, money flowing in from the sky, and with water on three sides, and the downtown east side, and downtown Vancouver almost as built up as it can be with skyscrapers, where is that all that money flowing? It's going to start to flow east through the downtown east side. So gentrification is happening there And that's taking and as a very powerful force.
And does that have an effect on the drug crisis?
You're seeing.
Before we get into will it, but has it? I mean, have you seen a difference in terms of, say, the numbers?
I mean, that's a difficult thing to quantify, but I think that it's worth acknowledging that the more people are having a hard time affording housing in the downtown east side who are already very low income, and I think it's fair to assume that it's human nature to look for stress relievers like drugs when you're placed under greater stress, like looking for housing and that sort of thing. And on a similar note, I'll note the financial crisis of 2008-2009 and sort of tie that into our booming real estate market. There's all these forces that are making it really tough for people to find to be able to afford a home in Vancouver. And the last place where a lot of them are looking is the downtown east side, where until very recently, at least, housing was relatively affordable. And so all those stresses on people can, easily make them more likely to do drugs.
And we're also hearing of slumlords and the sort of these SROs that are, and we hear of this one family in particular because they own one that the city's cracking down on. Why hasn't that been solved? And I mean, people in one hotel on Hastings, they were displaced recently because a building was condemned.
You're talking about the Sahota family who owns the Balmoral Hotel, the Regent, the Astoria, the Cobalt, four or five or six of not just the downtown east sides, but Vancouver's very worst options for housing.
Yeah, and so why can't the city, say, enforce the law, if you will? I mean, are there laws that could prevent them from, say, running buildings that are terrible as they are?
Yeah, there are. You know, we're a free market society that gives property owners a lot of independence and a lot of rights, but if you own a building where 200 people live, how you run that building is not entirely up to you. There are bylaws and that sort of thing that say minimum standards have to be enforced. You have to give people running water and that sort of thing. And the Sahotas have been known to violate those bylaws for years and years and years. The cities fine them and fine them, and they pay the fines, and every 5 years or so there's talk of a court case. But this has been a problem that's been going on for 20 years now. The headlines about these hotels that are written this week are the same headlines that were written about these hotels 20 years ago. So while there are rules that the city says are meant to address this sort of problem, they obviously haven't.
And why do you think they haven't? Well, does the city just say knock? I mean,
there's only so much you can do with a bylaw.
Yeah.
You know, a bylaw is not really that powerful.
It's not a
mechanism.
Criminal act, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And if the Sahotas or whoever have worked, you know, fines and that sort of thing into their business expenses, then the bylaws sort of lose their power.
Now, I remember in the 80s, you know, there was the heroin crisis, the crack crisis, and then that goes from the 80s to the 90s. Do you think, how do you see the fentanyl crisis end?
Well, how do I see it end? I don't think that the fentanyl crisis has reached its peak yet. I think it's going to continue to get worse, as bad as it's gotten already. I'll take a second to deliver the stats if I can.
Yeah.
In 2012, across British Columbia, there were 269 overdose deaths, 332 in 2013, and then 368 in 2014, and then 517 in 2015, and then 967 in 2016. And this year, for the first time, we're on track for more than 1,500 overdose deaths. I'll just take a second to think about that number. From 2001 to 2010, there was an average of 204 fatal overdoses in the province. An average each year for a decade, 204. And now we're at 1,500. It's the crisis. I don't know. These numbers begin to lose their meaning.
Yeah.
Like, they've gotten so large, you begin to have trouble comprehending them. All of that said, I don't think we're actually at the worst of it yet. There are jurisdictions across the United States, when you adjust for population, with rates of overdose deaths that are even much higher than what BC is seeing right now. And while BC is actually doing a relatively good job responding to this crisis, even as the deaths continue to go up, I still don't think that we're doing what needs to be done to actually begin to turn this problem around.
So when you go to big cities across North America, the numbers are generally the same? I mean, have you seen an increase, like, say, in Manhattan or in Los Angeles or San Francisco or Toronto even?
Yeah, more on the East Coast
than
the West Coast across the United States. But, yeah, this is a continent's problem. It's not Canada. This is very much happening in the United States as well. In places like New Hampshire, in places like Ohio, in those areas, the fatal overdose rates adjusted for population are still even higher than BC's. But if you count British Columbia as a state and adjust for population, we are in the top five.
Huh.
BC really is one of the worst hit neighborhoods in North America, but not the worst.
And it's 1,500 people this year alone. That's 1,500 different people with 1,500 different stories. And you multiply that by, say, loved ones around them who are affected by all this.
Yeah, and I mean, I compare it to that average of 204. 1,500 is a lot of people for a population the size of British Columbia. And it's not just downtown Eastside people either. You know, it's terrible that for some reason a lot of people think that can be dismissed if it is just downtown Eastside people.
But there are people that do that, though.
We're seeing overdose death rates climb really fast in jurisdictions like Surrey and in jurisdictions like Victoria. It's not even a city of Vancouver problem. The same way that heroin sort of finally reached middle America and the suburbs, we're seeing this problem expand far beyond BC's first city in the urban core.
And the legalization of drugs scares a lot of people, right? It scares a lot of people that call open line shows or that say write elected officials online or call 311. But that generally is considered, say, the solution to all of this, right?
Well, in my mind, it is. I know that's not an opinion shared by anybody. But I think if you accept two basic facts, if you accept them as facts, number one, that people are going to use drugs. Humans have always used drugs. And even 40, 50 years into the war on drugs, we haven't slowed drug use rates at all. They're higher than ever. So people are always going to use drugs. Let's just accept that as the first fact. Mm-hmm. Right or wrong, it's going to happen. And then second, if you accept that British Columbia's drug supply is hopelessly polluted, that law enforcement can't stop this, that fentanyl is here to stay, that carfentanil, a drug that's even more dangerous, is now here to stay, and probably going to contaminate the drug supply even worse than it is today. If you accept those two things, people are going to do drugs and the drug supply is poisoned. I don't know what else you can do but legalize.
And with the legalization of marijuana shortly by the federal government, do you think that might change some attitudes in this country?
I think it could begin to slowly. I mean, these are big.
Marijuana has taken so long as it is.
Do we
have the time?
And most people have tried marijuana. So it's a drug that they're a little bit more comfortable with the idea of legalizing because they know that it's not this really scary thing. It's not that big a deal, actually. But hard drugs like heroin especially, people are scared of that drug. So it's going to be much, much tougher to change attitudes around it.
I remember a tweet that you made about 6 months ago that was rather poignant. You thought, seeing this day in and day out, that it was starting to get to you. How are you dealing with this? I mean, you are a reporter. You're at the front line of this crisis. We generally don't think of the people telling us what's happening as to their how they're dealing with it.
Yeah, I think that tweet was about an afternoon when the city of Vancouver sent out a media release saying there had been nine overdose deaths in the city the night before, 14 across the province. And it was just sort of like a punch to the gut. Vancouver doesn't have that big a population. So for nine deaths to occur in one night, it was a lot. Like it was a lot even during the worst months of this crisis. Nine deaths and 14 across the province in like 12 hours, it was a lot. And I'd already been covering this stuff every day for more than a year or 2 years, so you think you're sort of desensitized to it. And then you read this thing, 14 people dead in the last 12 hours, and it just sort of knocked a lot of us back, I think. How am I dealing with it day in, day out? It becomes a bit scary the extent to which it desensitizes you. I live on East Hastings Street at Main Street, and a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago maybe, I walked from my apartment's front door, the building's front door, 100 feet up to the corner where my bus stop is, and there was two police officers there with a sheet over a corpse next to me, and I'm just sitting there waiting for my bus, and there's a corpse next to you, and you know, it's an overdose. You can tell these things by the body language of the police officers usually.
Yeah.
If there's any foul play involved, they're very tense, and there's the entire area is roped off and that sort of thing.
Taped off in the elevator.
Yeah, an overdose. They're they look upset. They're not joking around, but they're much more casual with their body language and that sort of thing. And so you're waiting for your bus in the morning, and then there's a corpse next to you, somebody who died of an overdose, and that was 3 weeks ago. And then last week, 10:30 at night after a late dinner or something. I was walking home and about a block from my house, and there's another sheet over another body in the parking lot that I walk by on that street. And it starts to worry you a little bit how that doesn't really get to you. I live in a neighborhood where every few weeks I see a corpse on the ground. That's what this overdose crisis is doing to that community.
And I mean, these are people that you probably know, right?
The downtown east side is a pretty small neighborhood.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody. It's like a village that way. I didn't see what was under those sheets, but I would not be surprised in the least bit if I recognized their faces.
You saw them around and things like that, right? Yeah. Are you talking with your colleagues who also work this beat, if you will, who report about crime and how they're reacting to what's happening in the city?
Yeah, I think that reporters don't talk about themselves a lot in the public. We're pretty uncomfortable doing that because we cover everybody else's lives,
mm.
and we're actually taught not to insert ourselves into the story. But I think people would be very surprised to learn the number of Vancouver journalists who have lost people very close to them as a result of this crisis. I've lost, I would call them acquaintances, I guess. You know, friends I used to have in high school or that sort of thing. Friends I haven't seen in 10 years, those sorts of people.
Yeah.
I haven't lost anybody directly like, that I would call very close to me, but I do know other journalists who cover this stuff who have lost people very close to them.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other thing that interests me when I talk to journalists on this program is I mean, you've worked overseas and you've covered conflicts and the sort. I mean,
post-conflict.
Yeah.
I was there usually a few years after a war.
Sure, but I mean, you can see what happens after, you know.
Yeah.
A great number of deaths. Do journalists in general react to death differently than, say, the rest of us?
I think that we sort of teach ourselves to. You know, it's a lot of dark humor. It's just a defense mechanism, right? We're not actually callous people. We just sort of put up these walls where we make jokes about this stuff. It helps you sort of get through it and roll
yeah.
it off your back when you're dealing with it every day. But like I mentioned a minute ago, it does get a bit scary when you realize the extent to which you've been desensitized. It catches up with you every so often as well. Last winter, I call it the endless winter, when we saw overdose deaths really skyrocket like they never had before,
mm-hmm.
you know, even a couple of years into the crisis, beginning last September, overdose deaths just... I'll jump to the stats one more time
mm-hmm.
if I can. There were 60 overdose deaths in BC in September last year, September 2016. And then 75 in October, 135, and then 159 in December. They skyrocketed even beyond where the crisis was already. And I think part of that was the arrival of carfentanyl, which is an opinion the authorities share now too. But also I think a big part of it was just how unusually cold and how usually long that winter was.
Snowed forever, right?
Yeah, and what that did was keep people inside, kept people in their rooms where they used drugs alone, where there wasn't people to save them if they overdosed. And so downtown, when I was walking home late at night or whatever, the alleys would be empty,
mm-hmm.
and that's unusual for the downtown east side.
Yeah.
The alleys in the downtown east side are usually quite busy with people. And I caught this thought occurring to me one evening, was just looking at the empty alleys. Was it, is everybody dead? Is that where everybody went?
Yeah.
I think they were probably just in the rooms because it was cold, but it was a strange thought to mull over.
So if a journalist papers over whatever they're feeling with say, dark humor to get through it all, how does a journalist not lose their empathy, say?
The stories that you hear keep your empathy strong. you know, like all I do really is sit on the phone and chat with people. The people that I'm talking to, they've actually lived through this stuff. They've actually lost people. And the stories that you hear of how they lost people, or the stories that you hear of how they've saved someone's life, there's also a lot of amazing stories that have come out of this crisis.
A lot of heroism, too.
Yeah. Nothing to take from firefighters and ambulance drivers and all this, and our paramedics. They've done an amazing job through this. But they're not actually the first responders in the downtown east side. They're second responders, usually coming to these scenes 10, 15 minutes after the real first responders, members of the community, and a lot of volunteers have already responded. They've already injected somebody with naloxone, the so-called overdose anecdote. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of heroism that's been involved in this crisis as well.
I mentioned a moment ago you went overseas to work as a journalist. Do you think that... Because you went all over the place, didn't you?
Yeah, I started in Malawi with a Toronto-based organization called Journalists for Human Rights. So I taught journalism there, sort of stationed in a local newspaper, and then also did a lot of freelancing. I was in Malawi for about a year, and then up in Liberia with the same organization for about a year, and then on my own for a while in Liberia and Sierra Leone.
What is the travel, the being outside of your hometown? I mean, that obviously gives you perspective to this town, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. My first couple of years back were a bit tough in a way. Nothing held my interest anymore. Real estate's a real problem in this city, and now we have the drug overdose crisis, which is a really intense problem. But other than that, Vancouver doesn't have a lot of problems. Like, this is a city that's consistently ranked in contests all over the world as one of the most livable. We're always called as one of the most beautiful. One is the, you know, we talk about cronyism and government corruption and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but it's like, it's on a different miniaturized scale here compared to how it is in many other areas.
It's almost quaint, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like cute almost.
Yeah.
After I got back from Liberia and Sierra Leone, especially, it was a bit tough to take what people called problems here seriously. And so it became a bit tough for journalism to hold my interest. But then, you know, you start to sort of slowly click back in and you begin to care about the things that the other people around you do.
So what keeps you here then?
The past couple of years, it's been the drug crisis. I mean, it's only one day every few weeks, less than that I get off. It's especially beginning with that endless winter I always mentioned, beginning last September. It's just been every single day I've been working on this.
And I mean, so how do you, say, decompress, if you will?
I don't know that I do.
You don't? Yeah.
Beginning in October, I also began writing a book about drugs in British Columbia. Actually mostly set in the 1990s and earlier 2000s, but with many of the same players involved in the response to fentanyl today. And I was on a really, really tight schedule to write that book. So it's been a very, very long time since I've had the opportunity to decompress.
And so the book comes out this fall, right?
Yeah, this October.
Arsenal Pulp.
Yep.
So the people that you do talk to, I mean, do they give you any insight as to how this might turn out? Because they've seen epidemics in the past in this town, right?
That's a big part of the book, is we try and recount. Younger people might not know, but this is BC's second overdose crisis. BC's first overdose crisis began in the 1990s when overdose deaths jumped from 30, 40, 50 a year to 150, 200, 300 deaths a year. It was an equally significant jump, but populations were smaller and it wasn't as acute as the fentanyl crisis. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was terrifying. And it was also combined with the outbreak of AIDS, which was actually, for a time, killing even more people in Vancouver than drugs were. And they happened at the exact same time. So we were losing a lot of people those years, too, in the mid-90s and early 2000s. And again, there was this really cool community response. It was volunteers. It was members of the community. It was activists. It was very much activists who led Vancouver's response to drugs in the 1990s. Quite similar to how we're seeing today. Vancouver's been through this before. And so what the book tries to do is sort of tell that story and share it with other jurisdictions, American jurisdictions as well, to sort of say, like, hey, Vancouver's been through this. Maybe there's something we can learn here. And in a lot of ways, our response to the 90s was a resounding success.
You saw InSight come up.
We saw North America's first supervised injection site come up. We saw needle exchange massively expand in Vancouver. And we really brought those numbers back down. Overdose deaths that spiked around 400 a year in 1998 dropped back down to that average I mentioned earlier of 2004. So this activist-led response in the 90s cut the OD rate in BC in half. That's a pretty incredible success what was really a group of drug users. It was largely led by drug users themselves, which is pretty cool.
Back to the challenges of your job. Despite it all, despite the long hours and the desensitization, if you will, that happens in various aspects, do you find the work at all rewarding? Because, I mean, young people nowadays are told by, say, older people that this is not a line of work to get into.
Well, I don't know if I can recommend it.
Really? Even after all these years?
It's become a really tough industry. I mean, it'll begin a whole other conversation, but I'm very pessimistic and quite depressed about the state of journalism and how much worse I think it's going to get even than it is today. But for sure, there are days where it's incredibly rewarding. You know, when you hear somebody just tell you this amazing story of such incredible hardship and then overcoming that hardship and how they did it, and then you get to share that story with the world. Like, it's really, really cool to be able to share somebody's story and realize that other people are going to benefit from that.
So if you don't recommend it as a line of work, well, I mean, who's going to be doing it 10, 15 years down the line?
It's a rough transition we're going through. Some aspects of the industry are going to be okay. The New York Times is doing all right. The Wall Street Journal is doing all right. CNN is doing all right. But those are really national outlets. The New York Times is fully a national outlet now.
Yeah.
We're losing. Let's talk about cities like Boston. Let's talk about cities like Philadelphia. And in not very long from now, let's talk about cities like Vancouver. I think that they're going to lose their journalism.
And I mean, we've already lost the 24 hours in terms of their sort of, their opinion pieces, and that there's no real reporting.
We've completely lost 24 hours. Yeah. That's not a Vancouver paper anymore. It's distributed here, but that's it.
Yeah.
And we've lost half of the Vancouver Sun, like fully half of it already.
Yeah.
It's essentially merged with the province. There's still fantastic people there, and I love them to death. But as an institution, it's half gone already.
So then, what does this mean then for me, the media consumer, the citizen? I mean, am I not getting what I need to know?
You're absolutely not.
Really?
You know, their school board coverage used to be a regular thing.
How often do you? Someone on the beat, right?
Yeah. I always say that what a time to be a politician, because nobody's watching you. daily newspapers for cities in Manitoba used to have bureau chiefs in Ottawa watching Manitoba's federal politicians, how they're acting in Ottawa. It's been years since we've had that sort of thing.
Maybe we lost Peter O'Neill in the...
Yeah, Vancouver. Yeah. Vancouver doesn't have the reporters that it used to in Ottawa watching our Vancouver representatives at the federal level. We've already lost that coverage. There's so much... it's a negative what you're missing. So it's a difficult thing to notice that you've lost. But I think that there's already so much that we've lost that people haven't quite realized yet.
How is your paper doing? I noticed that in the summer it's rather thin.
Yes.
But I mean, but that's always been thin during the summer. But
yes.
Compared to say the spring, to a spring, 4 or 5 years ago, I mean it has gotten a little thinner, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The Strait had a bit of an advantage in the media crash that began in 2006-07. While so many newspapers, especially the dailies, had to struggle with a loss of revenue as news moved online, people canceled their print subscriptions. The Georgia Strait never had paid subscribers, so we were cushioned that way a little bit. We never lost subscription revenue because we never had it.
Mm-hmm.
That was never part of our model. Now we're struggling a bit with the loss in advertising revenue. There was the loss of classifieds that once Craigslist was created, and then there was the loss of subscription revenue, and now there's the loss of advertising revenue. And some newspapers are really struggling with that. I think it's 70 cents of every dollar spent in online advertising goes to two corporations. Of course, Google and Facebook. So 30 cents of every dollar spent on advertising is split up by every other newspaper in North America. Every newspaper in North America just has that tiny 30% to split between them. The loss of advertising revenue is a really big problem for newspapers today.
But the content, though, in terms of the reporting in the Strait that you do and that your colleagues do, I mean, that's continued throughout, hasn't it?
Yeah, we're hanging in there.
8 years
sure.
or so?
Yeah, we're hanging in there. I mean, we've never done a round of layoffs.
Yeah. And so do you foresee that continuing?
I do. I mean, nobody's ever, ever even raised the prospect of doing anything but continuing. We just celebrated our 50th anniversary, and off the top, you mentioned a couple of awards that the newspaper's done recently. So we're hanging in there, but it's a tough time for the entire industry.
So we've talked about pretty dour things.
Yeah.
Are you, as a young person, are you generally hopeful about the future? I mean, for not only yourself, but this town?
That's an interesting question. There's a lot to be depressed about right now. Polarization of politics led by the United States, and this lack of trust in the media, where we don't even agree on realities anymore, that really worries me.
Are you seeing that a lot, though, in your conversations with, say, civilians and people that don't work in the media or who just really consume whatever they watch on television or read online, that there is a difference between what you're thinking about and the reality of what you're thinking about and what they're thinking about, say?
Not in Canada like I do in the United States.
Yeah.
I honestly believe that. Polarization in Canada is not even on the same, is not even close to on the same level as it is in the United States right now. It sounds conceited, and it's also tough to quantify, but I do view us as a more reasonable people.
But these things move north, though, don't they? And
they absolutely
they trend
do.
North,
Very
don't
often what happens in the United States happens in Canada 10 years later. Obama to Trudeau. So if the United States has Trump right now, who do we have coming to Canada? So that's something I'm worried about. The overdose crisis is depressing, but I do see real opportunities for change there. Solutions are often born of a crisis. And if 50 years into the war on drugs, finally so many people die that we can finally begin to talk about ending that war on drugs, which is a war on people, it's not a war on drugs,
mm-hmm.
That might be a silver lining to this terrible situation.
Well, I hope you'll come back for your book in the fall.
I would love to.
And continued good luck with all of your endeavors. As I said off the top, I've come to rely on your work, and I've appreciate you coming in to do this and sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you for reading.
TLupik.com and @TLupik is the Twitter handle. The Georgia Straits, Travis Lupik. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.